This is Norman B's Life Elsewhere, the show about art, media, and culture.
Hello there. Welcome to Life Elsewhere. I'm Norman B. In today's show, a conversation about sci-fi, cosplay, fanboys, and fangirls. They all come together in The Speed of Clouds, the debut novel from Miriam Seidel. The Philadelphia-based Star Trek fan will join me to talk about the inner lives of sci-fi fans, including intimate relations with a cyborg. First, what apparently began as a money laundering operation evolved into something far more ambitious, ending with an either willfully ignorant or inexplicably unaware Donald Trump in the White House, a Russian asset who had become the most powerful man on Earth. This is the background to a new must-read book, House of Trump, House of Putin, the untold story of Donald Trump and the Russian Mafia. The author, Craig Unger, is my guest. Hello, Craig. Welcome to Life Elsewhere.
Thanks for having me, Norman.
Now, Craig, my first question, what do the Russians have on Donald Trump?
I went back to 1984 is one of the first episodes in which a Russian mobster came to Trump Tower, brought in millions of dollars, $6 million, it's the equivalent of about $15 million a day, and he said, I'll take five condos. And that was the first episode I could find in which the Russians were using Trump properties to launder money. And that was the beginning, and it went on. I think a lot of the when you ask what do they have on him, I think a lot of it's hiding in plain sight. He is a creature of the Russian mafia. They brought him back to life when he was $4 million in debt. And there are two elements of this that I'd like to unpack. And one is that the Russian mafia, when Americans hear the term mafia, most of us think of the Godfather and the Italian-American mafia. The Russian mafia is quite different in a hugely important way. It is a state actor. Russia is a mafia state, and they operate in the same way Navy SEALs or a CIA covert operation might act. They serve Vladimir Putin. At the top of the mafia state is President Putin, and when you unpack that a bit and you realize how dependent, Trump is upon them, how they saved him, his business career, that they live in Trump Tower. Many of them have been living, buying condos and living in Trump Tower or working out of there. Now, think what a massive security breach this is to have ties that go right to the Kremlin in the home of the man who is now President of the United States.
Yes, indeed. We're talking to Craig Unger. His book is House of Trump, House of Putin. I'm going to ask a question which almost seems silly on the face of it. And that is, all the sort of stories, the scandalous stories we've heard about Trump, some we know are true, and some, of course, we're still wondering, are they true or not? Really, none of that sort of matters in some respects, in that Trump is beholden, as from what you're saying, to the Russian mafia purely for one word, money, money, money.
Absolutely, I agree with it. At the same time, I certainly wasn't looking to uncover sexual scandals in this, but I have to say that I did talk to someone who was very close to the Russian mafia, and he brought up that they had compromise on him. I also talked to a General Oleg Kalugin, who he was head of counterintelligence for the KGB, but he now lives outside Washington, D.C., and I met him in his house. And when I asked him about the Russian mafia, he said, oh, that's another branch of the government. They report to the KGB. And part of it was that Putin had weaponized the mafia, and they were working in Trump Tower. That sort of put things in a completely new perspective for me.
Here's another question, Craig, which, again, I'm going to sort of preface it by saying it does sound rather silly, and that is Trump a willing partner in this whatever you want to call it, compromise or whatever you describe it as?
I think in the end he's going to regret that he actually ran for president, because he could have gone through the rest of his life I mean, he seemed happy as a multi-billionaire and without having any real level of inspection. Once you become president of the United States, a lot of people begin to delve into this, and I suspect he's going to regret it.
Yeah.
And I also think the tide may start turning as Mueller is closing in again and again, and it'll be very interesting what happens after the midterms, if the Democrats take the House.
Do you think that Trump's, after all the research you did for your book, House of Trump, House of Putin, do you think that the big, big problem that Trump has is ego, that his ego is so fragile that that's what set him off in this direction?
Well, I don't want to psychoanalyze the guy. I mean, I think he's deep, a very, very sick guy, to be honest. And it was interesting talking to people who were part of the Russian mafia who ended up, they thought he was, they had contempt for him. In many ways, I think it is ego in some way. I think it's simply, this was a quick fix. When people started coming to him, throwing bagfuls of money to buy condos, willing to pay top dollar, not even negotiate, Trump decided not to ask questions, and they became his favorite customers, and the Russians were everywhere in Trump Tower, in another building called Trump World Tower, in his Miami properties, in Panama, all over the world.
Do you think, Craig, that it's possible that Trump has been wired this whole time, that the Russians have been taping, they've been videotaping, that just have lots of documentary evidence or blackmail material even?
Well, it's certainly possible, and it's hard for me as a rule. I just don't like to speculate if I don't have material.
Yeah.
But one of the most interesting things in the Steele dossier that I found flabbergasting was it said that Trump was funneling intelligence to the Kremlin, and I thought that couldn't possibly be because he's so undisciplined. I mean, would you really want him to be a spy? But when I got into his dealings more and more, I realized that there was a real estate development company in Trump Tower called Bayrock, that it had lots and lots of ties to Russia and the Russian mafia and Russian intelligence. And they partnered with Trump, developing properties like the Trump Soho here in New York, and other Trump Towers all over the world. So they were raising money that came from Russian flight capital, and they were laundering it by pouring it into their new real estate developments. They were also selling condos to Russian oligarchs. So they would have all that data, and Putin wants to keep tabs on their on his oligarch. That's really important to his power base. And they easily had channels that were very, very close to the Kremlin.
What's your knowledge about the rest of the Trump family and their involvement? How much do they know?
Well, I think Donald Jr. may well be in trouble, obviously, as a result of the June 2016 meeting. And it seems to me his emails on the face of it were unbelievable. People, the Trumps keep saying, oh, there's, we didn't get what we wanted out of the meeting, so there was no collusion. Well, that's absurd. Think of it just from the point of view of Russian intelligence. They send emails to Donald Trump. Donald Trump Jr., offering up intelligence from the Russians. And Donald Trump Jr. waits a total of 17 minutes before responding, I love it. 17 minutes.
Yes.
Now, does that tell you he is security conscious or not? They know that he is an easy, easy mark. And he has left a paper trail through email that documents that he is willing to accept compromise from the Russians. That's not a good sign, and they've learned that before the meeting even takes place. So they learned a lot about it just from setting up the meetings.
Now, I know that you don't want to speculate, and you've already made that very clear, but I've got to ask you about Helsinki and about just your, I guess, just from your observations, just what you surmise must have gone on, and why we saw this most peculiar performance, because that's what it was. It was a performance by Donald Trump. Just your take on the whole Helsinki pantomime.
Well, it was an embarrassment beyond belief, I think, in a certain way, because, you just saw Trump kowtowing him. And the only rationale for this is if he is in Putin's pocket. There's no other way to explain it. To see it being acted out on the world stage is sort of humiliating. But this is when you see that we're approaching an election now, and there have already been reported threats that the Russians are hacking into our electoral systems for the November elections. We have in place a president who is doing nothing about it. And he's doing nothing about it because he benefits by allowing the Russians to take over.
Now, let's just focus in just for a moment on Putin, the House of Putin. In the big picture, in the big scheme of things, Craig, what is Putin getting out of everything that he has on Trump?
He's getting at a lot, and I think you really can't understand what happens unless we look at the history and look at it from Putin's point of view. And Putin has said repeatedly that he thought the death of the Soviet Union was the greatest catastrophe in world history. Mm. And even afterwards, things got worse for Putin because one by one, all the East Bloc satellites that were part of the Soviet Union began to join NATO. From Putin's point of view, Ukraine was the last straw. And we saw in 2004 the Orange Revolution. We've seen the constant battles. We saw Putin install a pro-Putin puppet, President Viktor Yanukovych,
yes,
as president of Ukraine, using Paul Manafort as the key political strategist. And now, in many ways, I think that was... that foreshadowed what Putin was doing, using Manafort again, but this time to install a pro-Putin president in the White House.
Let me ask you this about Manafort. Do we have any idea whether Manafort has been compromised in any way?
Well, I have to laugh. I mean, you know, everything about Manafort, if you hear it from Trump, it's completely misrepresented. He acts like he's only known Manafort for a few weeks.
Yeah.
In fact, they go back to 1980 when Manafort first worked for him. Manafort's lobbying firm, which had various names, but it was once Black, Manafort, and Stone, became the lobbying firm for the great dictators of the world. It was known as a torturer's lobby, and they sort of reveled, he and Roger Stone reveled in defending the worst dictators on earth, and they eventually went to Putin. And that's how things started. And Manafort has serious financial troubles, but he was being paid $10 million a year by Russian oligarchs. So he made huge amounts of money, at least $60 or $70 million. And it's fascinating when you look what happened to that money, because now he's pleading bankruptcy. But some of it was laundered by shell companies that have been tied to the Russian mafia. So I think he's got some real problems. Obviously, he's already been convicted. And it'll be very interesting. He can cooperate with federal authorities after having been convicted to get a reduced sentence. And now he's either facing the rest of his life in jail, or he has to cooperate. So, Bob, you know who has... compromise on Manafort is Bob Mueller, and we'll see how that plays
out. Yes.
But Manafort knows an awful, awful lot. When he was in Ukraine, Manafort doesn't speak Russian or Ukrainian, so he had a sidekick named Konstantin Kalimnik, who was tied to Russian military intelligence. And he was, Manafort was deeply, deeply compromised.
What a story this is, really. When you started writing your book, when you first started getting all the details and getting research, and was it overwhelming for you? I mean, I guess you knew where you were going, but just talk to me about just putting the book together.
You know, that's a good question, because when I first heard about the Russian mafia, I frankly thought my source was going a bit too far. But the first thing I did was I got a list, a database. New York State, you can get the owners of every residential property in New York State. So I focused on all the Trump properties. And every time I came to a Russian name, I'd write it down and Google it. And when you do an investigative reporting, you normally hit a lot of dry holes.
Yeah.
But by filtering names by, it sounded Russian to me, and they lived in a Trump, they own Trump branded property, it was like hitting the jackpot in Vegas or something, time after time after time. Everyone was either laundering money or gunned down on Sixth Avenue, or huge number indicted for being part of the Russian mafia again and again and again. You know, Trump has always said he has no ties to Russia. I found at least 59 Russian contacts over the year between him, 59 people who are contacts between him and Russia over the years, and a whole lot of them are part of the Russian mafia.
There's a word that he says over and over again, and I'm sure he'll repeat it again today, and that is collusion, collusion, collusion. And I guess I can imagine with what you've written with your book, House of Trump, House of Putin, that word must just strike you as being very funny.
That's absolutely right, because people say, well, where's the proof? The proof is the whole story. It's been going on for at least 34 years. It's told through the 59 contacts I go through in my book. And I believe this is sort of a roadmap to what Robert Mueller knows and is following.
Well, I wish, Craig, that we had a lot more time. Craig Unger is the author. He's a New York Times best-selling author. His book, House of Bush, House of Bush, House of Sally, and also House of Trump and House of Putin, his most recent book. It is a must-read. Craig Unger, thank you so very much for joining us at Life Elsewhere.
Thanks for having me, Norman.
Now don't forget, you can go to lifeelsewhere.co to find the links to the books we feature on the program. All right, standby fans of sci-fi, cosplay, or perhaps you're a proud fanboy or fangirl. Or maybe you'd like a fascinating conversation about all these topics and more. Author Miriam Seidel will join me next to talk about the speed of clouds. Oh, and it really helps if you give me some feedback. Let me know what you think of the show. The nice lady now will give you the email address.
We'd love to hear what you have to say. Write to this address, info@lifeelsewhere.co. That's C-O.
My guest is Miriam Seidel, and she has written a book that I have been talking about, badgering people about in the office here at Life Elsewhere Towers. The book is called The Speed of Clouds, and it's her debut novel. Miriam Seidel, welcome to Life Elsewhere.
Thanks so much, Norman. I'm glad to be here.
So I've been talking about this book for a couple of weeks now, and really trying to sort of see what people's reactions will be when I go on and on and on about it. But here's the problem, Miriam. It's obviously I like this book because I've been going on about it, but I don't like telling the whole story when I love a book so much. I don't want to give it away. I want my listeners to go and get a copy. So this is to begin. Let's see if we can't just tell everybody a little bit about the book without giving up too much away.
Sure. So it's about a young woman named Mindy. She's in her early 20s. She is in a wheelchair with spina bifida and lives with her mom and helps her out at flea markets. So she's not really moving out into the world the way she might have, partly because of her health issues. But at the beginning of the story, she's been both running a fan club for the very, very popular TV and movie franchise Skylog, which she's a great big fan of, and also editing a fanzine for Skylog fans. But she's just sort of been kicked out of the club that she ran. And that was a kind of a big blow to her ego, because it's one of the big things she was doing. And then a good friend sort of drags her to another Skylog club, and she's, you know, things happen, and she's kind of, in the course of the book, she kind of grows up emotionally. How's
yes,
that?
I think that was really good. I think I was glad that you did that, because I think I would have gone on a little too long and I probably would have given a lot away. We're talking to Miriam Seidel. This is her debut novel. It's called The Speed of Clouds. Okay, so let's get into it. This book is really, I guess, it's a sort of an emotional change of life story alongside a sci-fi story alongside. It's a number of sort of themes sort of merging together here. It's about fans. It's about, it's about a lot of different things. So let's begin at one of the areas that I'm really a little, I'm not apprehensive so much as the last time I talked about science fiction on the program, I started it off by saying I'm not a science fiction fan. And having said that, after reading a number of science fiction books, I realized maybe I've been sort of ignoring a genre that I should have paid more attention to. So your book really is based in science fiction, yet it's not a science fiction book, is it?
Right. Someone just said to me, oh, is it meta science fiction? I wasn't sure about that, but if that helps anybody think about it, that's fine. There are science fiction stories that come in through the fanzine. So some of Mindy's contributors are sending her continuing stories that develop through that are basically science fiction. But really, it was kind of like my way of trying to show where science fiction and real life can overlap. And that sort of feeling that when you're living at that border between like real life, IRL, and an imaginary world, that you can sometimes, there's this sort of bleed through that can occur where, for me at least, you get to this feeling of, oh my God, this moment is just like, this is science fiction. So it sort of makes the world itself stranger.
Yes, and there's a parallel story that goes along, as well as the stories that, as you say, some of the contributors to the magazine send in by email to your, I guess I was going to say heroine, but she's not really a heroine, is she? She's not. What would you call her? What would you call Mindy?
Say main character, but I think she's heroic in some ways. She certainly has a lot of difficulties to deal with, and I think she's strong too.
Yeah.
But at the beginning, she just hasn't gotten very far.
Right. So let's talk about Mindy for a moment. So why did you decide to make Mindy have spina bifida and be in a wheelchair?
Mm-hmm. Good question. I had been going to conventions, Star Trek conventions, for a few years and just loved them without particularly wanting to admit that I was a fan. But I think I must have seen people that are sort of like Mindy, but I don't remember anyone in particular. But then she just sort of came to me as a character, and I didn't know what to do with her. At that time, I was writing short fiction and dramatic stuff. And at a certain moment, the rest of the story coalesced around her. But that's, you know, a little bit avoiding why to make her disabled. You know, there were a couple of reasons. One is that one reason that I wrote the book is it was a kind of way for me to revisit my high school self.
Ah.
And when I was very much in my head and just sort of a very bookish and serious, and didn't really let loose till later. So I felt like maybe this was a way to make that more visible. She's got a visible disability.
Now, did you have escapist fantasies like Mindy?
I did have escapist. I basically would just immerse myself in whatever it was I was interested in, which was books and movies. This was a little before I wasn't part of fan fiction because that really hadn't gotten going at that point. But yes, I certainly had a vivid imagination, and she does too.
Yes, she certainly does. Now, it would have been so easy to make her a pathetic figure, but you don't do that. You, as you say, she is rather heroic, and she certainly has opinions, and she lets you know what she's thinking a lot of the time, although she has got her issues, she has got her problems. Right. Let's talk about the characters, because I think one of the splendid things about your book is that you round out the characters, not just Mindy, but a lot of the other bit players as well, shall we call them. You make them very realistic. Talk to me about the characters.
Yes. Well, some of them are actually inspired by real people that I knew. One in particular was the character of Roxy, the older woman who's an artist who becomes sort of a mentor to Mindy. I knew an older woman artist that was kind of like Roxy, and it was just so much fun to let her loose as a fictional character. And I have to say, to make up her artwork was just pure fun for me.
Yeah.
Other people I don't think are so directly taken, but I don't know. I feel like, you know, these people are important. And oftentimes with fandom, you'll see the people, particularly in costumes, just caricatured. And I felt like, that when I was at the cons, I felt the poignancy and the depth of their feeling for these things, and I wanted the people behind the costumes to be real and fully human.
Now, you just mentioned two words, which I think we're going to have to explain for our listeners mm-hmm. that aren't into cons and fandom, because these are things people that know about it, but people that don't are probably sitting there scratching their heads. So we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk about cons and fandom with Miriam Seidel.
You're listening to the best show on radio about art, media, and culture. Life Elsewhere with Norman B.
If you're just joining us, my guest is the author of The Speed of Clouds. It's her debut novel. It's Miriam Seidel. She's in Philadelphia. Miriam, you mentioned cons and fandom. So cons comes from comic cons or conventions. Is that right?
Conventions, yes. Yes. So that is still a huge phenomenon. In the 90s, when the book is set, it was really just kind of getting started and coalescing around Star Trek. But now there are many, many kinds of cons. And I think most people have heard of the big San Diego Comic Con. So it's just a place for people to gather. So one of the things that immediately entranced me was this dressing up thing, which now is called cosplay.
Yes.
So that's another fan term that actually comes from Japan. But, people are doing it all over the world. And to me, it was just like, oh, my God, I'm seeing this new way of expressing this very primal human drive, which is to dress up and get transformed.
Yes.
And, I feel like, back, thousands and, hundreds of thousands of years ago, humans were transforming themselves around the fire with maybe painting their bodies or making the first masks, and they would become something different and probably part of the spirit world. And I think that dressing up has kept that sense of enchantment, which is often missing from our lives.
Now, would you say that fandom and comic cons just goes together? The two are always together. You can't be a fan without being at a comic con, so to speak.
Yes and no. I think that there are people. There's the fan fiction is another term.
Ah.
Right. So I think that there are probably a lot of people who are, you know, just love these fictional worlds. And now there's fan fiction about Harry Potter, about many, you know, Twilight, about many TV shows. And that may be their main way of participating in the fan community, which, you know, you can just post to one of these websites and you can get followers who read your work regularly. And it's very fulfilling, and also I think a really interesting sort of democratizing phenomenon. If you're into cosplay, you kind of have to get together with other people, and that's another reason I love it, because nowadays people are so into their digital lives, and this dressing up thing, it puts you back into your body. So it's a kind of a completion of the circle where you're watching something on TV or you're reading a book, and then you kind of are imagining yourself in it. And then you're actually putting yourself in it with these amazing costumes that I just admire and love.
Now, you've been to many comic cons. I guess. Do you call them comic? You just call them cons now. You don't call them comic cons.
Yeah, comic con would be focusing on the world of comics.
Oh, the comics, and right. Yeah. Yes. Now let's get back to talking about your book. It's your debut novel. It's called The Speed of Clouds. One aspect of your book, which I think is really important, is not just the development of the characters, which I think you do exceedingly well, is also the dialogue. You have this amazing ability to tell us what Mindy's thinking, but you also give us dialogue at the same time. And I think that's an art which not a lot of people can do well, and you certainly have achieved that. Talk to me about the dialogue.
Well, thank you. I mean, one thing, yes, I wanted to give people that sense of being in Mindy's head and what's happening while she's answering, which might be at cross purposes to what she actually says. I think that it came from finding Mindy's voice, which is, you know, sort of no nonsense, and then just applying that as I went through. You know, there's high language and there's conversational language, and I love them all.
Yeah. And, I want to ask you about some of the characters, particularly Mindy's mother and father. Now, they have a very odd relationship. You described that. And just the way they speak to one another, but they're fans as well, aren't they?
Yes, that's true. That's a very good point. Her father, who is separated but still very amicably comes and visits, is sort of equally into Skylog along with Mindy, and has taken her. He was the one that started taking her to the conventions, and her mom is probably not that much into it, but is a big sort of old movie fan. Yeah. And as a flea market and collectibles dealer, she's very involved with that part of it. So yeah, that does speak to the idea that people can have their own obsessions. I'm someone that tends to get obsessed with things, and you know, this book is an example of that. But yes, it can certainly express in a lot of different ways.
So we talked earlier about when you were in high school, in your younger years, that you identified with some of the characteristics of Mindy. So I've got to ask you, so is Mindy throughout based on a lot of Miriam Seidel?
Maybe I'd like to say of her high school self. Someone did ask me at a book reading, were you ever that irritated with your mother? And have those kind of spats with her? And I just laughed because my mom was there. And I went over and I gave her a big hug and I said, of course I did, because that's the way it is when you're younger. Mm-hmm. But then hopefully you get through to, you know, a later stage. I think I had a tendency to be sitting on the outside and watching what was going on and maybe judging what was going on, which Mindy does do. Yeah.
Well, so of course I've got to ask you then, if that's the case, that your some of you is in Mindy, so the relationship she has with, I'm trying to remember his name, the cyborg Roy, is that how you say that?
Yes.
So what does Miriam Seidel know about relationships with cyborgs?
I have to say that was pretty much imagined. I am and was a big fan of Star Trek: The Next Generation, and I had my favorite characters, but I don't think I was as deep into it as Mindy.
So you weren't fantasizing about having intimate relationships with any of them?
I do have a big crush on Patrick Stewart, I have to say.
Okay, all right then. Okay, you heard it here first, everybody. We're talking to Miriam Seidel. It's her debut novel. It's called The Speed of Clouds. I want to talk to you about something which I don't know whether this has been approached with you or not, but that is a screenplay. We're going to do that right after this.
You're listening to My Dad, Norman B. in Life Elsewhere.
Okay, this time, try it a little faster.
You're listening to My Dad and Norman B. in Life Elsewhere.
The book is called The Speed of Clouds. It's the debut novel from Miriam Seidel. Miriam, this is such a good read. And whenever I have a book that I thoroughly enjoy and it captures my imagination and it's got such great dialogue and such well-developed characters, always I have to ask the question, have you thought in terms of a screenplay? Have you thought in terms of this being on the big screen?
I mean, yes and no. I guess I thought that it might be unfilmable. I guess that if somebody was going to do it, they would probably Hollywoodize some of the characters a little, which I'm not sure, I'm sure that could be done. If anyone wants to talk to me about it, they're welcome to. but no, it wasn't like something I was thinking about a lot. No.
But now I've mentioned it, and I'm sure you haven't thought about it a lot, as you say, but just let's talk about, because the way you've written the book, the way it goes together, and I keep focusing in on the dialogue and the characters and the sort of parallel stories that are happening at the same time. To me, it's very cinematic. So let's just go into that just a moment. And you said it would be, if it was made, it would have to be somewhat more Hollywood in style. So I don't know that it has to go in that direction. Help me out here. Can you see how it could be developed into a movie?
You might be right. I actually did write a screenplay before this, but it was specifically, I was imagining something on screen. I think you're right that of course imaginary worlds can be filmed now. I was so anticipating the movie of A Wrinkle in Time, which was one of my touchstone books growing up.
Yeah.
And I personally loved it. You can't please everybody, but
that's true. Yeah.
But I still love A Wrinkle in Time, and I think it should be like Shakespeare, where people get a crack at it and they do their own version of it, maybe, let's say, every 10 years.
Well, that's a good idea. I like that. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now let's transfer a little bit and talk about you, about Miriam Seidel, because I looked at your biography. You're not just an author. Talk to me about Miriam Seidel.
I seem to have gone from one thing to another. I do have a lot of sort of threads that have run through, which one of the wonderful things about writing this novel was discovering that I could put a lot of my interests into it. But I've always been interested in art, and I actually went to art school and was an artist for a while, and then later was a curator and an art critic. I also was serious about music. So when Zoo, who's Mindy's best friend, is a kind of a self-taught electronic musician who works with found sounds, that's not something I've done, but it is something I could totally get into. And I love new music, you know, experimental electronic music. And I actually do have a theremin. So
do you really?
Yes.
Oh,
yes.
My.
Oh. I got it as a treat, and I tried to teach myself to play it. It's a very hard instrument to master. But anyway, so just a spoiler alert, there is a theremin in The Speed of Clouds.
Which I think is wonderful.
Yeah. Cow, right?
Yeah. Yeah. The Speed of Clouds, of course, is the title of the book. It's a debut novel from Miriam Seidel. Names. Now, I want to talk to you about names because you had to do some, as well as doing a sort of a parallel story with the real world, you do a fantasy story, but you also, at the same time for the whole book, you're sort of mimicking Star Trek. So you had to come up with new names. Talk to me about coming up with names for The Speed of Clouds.
Well, it wasn't just names. I needed to kind of reimagine, you know, and in some ways it was very helpful because Roy, instead of being an android, as he might have been, is a cyborg, which is different.
What's the difference?
The difference being, an android is a robot who looks like a human being. And a cyborg is a sort of robotically enhanced human, really technologically enhanced human. So Mindy, kind of, I like to think as a sci-fi fan that she's aware of herself being kind of like a cyborg because she uses a wheelchair and at times crutches. That she gets the whole idea that there's a continuum. You know, that can go into the stranger and stranger, but that a lot of us are cyborgs now, you could argue. I'm sorry, we were talking about
No,
names.
No, that was great. That was fascinating. That's absolutely fascinating. I love that you explained that. Yeah.
Yeah, and I loved making up the names. I just felt like, okay, this is my personal playground, and I get to. I did kind of revise them as I went along. You know, I would have one name in there, and I'd get, no, I don't like that so much. I'm putting in another one. So, one principle that I kind of tried to keep to was that most of them should be pronounceable.
Yes.
Which is true in Star Trek as well,
yes.
I guess. But then I put in a few that were unpronounceable.
It's not easy, is it, coming up with those names and making them pronounceable, yet at the same time making them sort of alien-like? I guess that's the best way to describe it, isn't it?
Yeah. I think in an early draft, I had one planet that was named Warrenen 2, which is it's the name of a composer.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
But then I thought, okay, that's a little too... too much. So,
you know, Miriam, in listening to you talking about your book, I'm getting the feeling that you really enjoyed doing this. You loved putting it together. Am I right?
Yes, you are absolutely right. It was this discovery that, I can put in the world of art, and I can put in fandom, and, you know, I can, and all of this can also be tied to some real, you know, deep hurts and personal feelings. Just throwing in all these things. One other thing about, in terms of the connection to my high school experience was the Buckminster Fuller connection. Was that my high school did have a gym with a geodesic dome. And I think that's what made me aware of him at first. But then in Philadelphia, he has a slightly larger presence because he lived here for a while,
right.
Later in life. And so there are people walking around who knew him. And he was actually a futurist, you know, so he was like the fans do, who are always looking towards the future. He was also always thinking about how can we move towards a better future for humankind, like with his book Spaceship Earth and stuff. So I was like, oh, I can throw in Buckminster Fuller, you know.
Yes.
So yes, it was a joy.
That's so interesting, because when I was in high school, in my latter years in high school, I knew what I wanted to do. I wanted to go to art school. And Buckminster Fuller was a huge influence on me. And then when I went to art school, yes, indeed, was less like a major, major figure in my earlier years. Yeah. Gosh, what a coincidence that is.
That's great. Yes. Well, kudos.
so you really, really enjoyed writing the book and putting it together. I've got a question for you that I don't know. I'm just going to ask it anyway. Did you have to censor yourself when you were writing the book? Were there ideas that came up you're thinking about? And you said maybe that's going too far.
Well, I think I did go too far, and then part of the revising was making things mesh more. You know, like so that the ghost dance wasn't simply a historical thing, but it kind of bleeds through into the science fiction stories. So that Mindy, who has this alter ego called Cat Wanderer, in a way you can see who is a mission officer with the Skylog fleet. You can sort of see how she in the story that we're following with her alter ego through the novel, you can see that she's got some parallels with this woman Catherine Weldon, who was a real a white woman historically who got involved with the Indians right before the Ghost Dance happened, actually lived with Sitting Bull. Really fascinating woman who has not much is known about her, but she has been written about by a number of people. And that was also something that I was working on in that screenplay. So my own obsession with the Ghost Dance and Catherine Weldon came in, but I had to pare that back a bit. So yes, I think at the beginning I kind of threw everything in.
You threw everything in, yeah. Let me ask you, this book has to have been read now by pure sci-fi fans. When I say pure sci-fi fans, you know what I mean. I mean devoted sci-fi fans.
Yes.
What has been their take on The Speed of Clouds?
Well, unexpectedly wonderful. I really thought that I would have to kind of prove myself as a genuine fan. But I feel like I've been sort of welcomed into the sci-fi community, and it's gotten some very nice reviews that are mostly from women who are interested in sci-fi. And I have to say that in the last few years, the science fiction world has just exploded with new work by women writers, by writers of color, and queer writers. It's just a really amazingly, evolving and exciting place to be right now. So to be recognized by people who are interested in some of those writers is super, super wonderful. I'll just go teeny bopper there.
Now, at the beginning, answering my question there, when I asked you about sci-fi fans, how they looked at this book, how they reviewed this book, the first thing you said was women. You mentioned women first of all, and women play a very important part throughout your book in the whole story. Your heroic lead is Mindy, and then of course you say that the fan club is run mostly by women. Women are dominant in this book. Even her mother is sort of dominant over Irv, the father. So let me ask you about women's place in science fiction.
Yes, women's place in science fiction. Well, it's been changing. I think that there were always women, women fans, and there were always women writers. To me, when I was younger, being able to read Ursula Le Guin was really meaningful. But she wasn't the only one. She was just a successful and great writer. And I think that it just, it's maybe there are more men, but there's fanboys and fangirls.
Yes.
And both terms have now been claimed by their respective genders, you know, so it's like you're no longer, you know, ashamed to be a fangirl. You're proud of it. And there's that that interesting sort of Mary Sue subplot in the novel, which that's a real thing where it was actually came from a short story written by a fan fiction writer many decades ago who had a character named Mary Sue that was she made her deliberately sort of over the top, brilliant, beautiful, and accomplished, and saves the day. And that became a term that was kind of thrown around in the fan fiction community, where, you know, women, it might be sort of to put writers down, you know, so that you could say, well, that's just a Mary Sue. But then, well, isn't wish fulfillment okay sometimes? So it's something that Mindy struggles with in the course of the story.
Do you have any data on how many women read science fiction as opposed to men?
I should, but I don't. I was looking into cosplay, but what I found was that there's a whole lot of much younger people that are doing cosplay now. And among them, I think many, many of them are women. Cosplay is also just really kind of fun and sexy. And I think it's a great way for people to just, you know, reclaim themselves through these different personas. I have a niece who's into cosplay, so there's my very anecdotal evidence.
You just said a word which I can't let pass by without focusing in on, and that is sexy. There is a certain sort of sexy thing about cosplay and about science fiction. Times that I've read science fiction and sort of got into it a little bit, there does seem to be this sexy thing that happens, and it sort of permeates throughout science fiction stories and movies. And let's talk about sexy in science fiction, and we're going to do that right after this.
Thank you for listening to Life Elsewhere, hosted by Norman B. To learn more about our program, our guests, and the music we feature, go to lifeelsewhere.co. That's C-O.
My guest is Miriam Seidel. Her debut novel is The Speed of Clouds. So here you are. It's the question that, oh gosh, sexy, sexy in science fiction. Why is sex, why does it rear its beautiful head in science fiction so often?
Well, I guess we're going to need to have sex in the future too. I mean, it's just, maybe it's just that liberating quality of being able to be in a what-if world. That when you feel liberated in one way, maybe you feel liberated in another way. So, certainly, in historic science fiction, in what they call the Golden Age, when most of the writing was by men, you had a lot of, you know, very cute, scantily clad, you know, nymphettes and alien, you know, female aliens and that kind of thing.
You're talking about Barbarella now, aren't you?
Yes, exactly. Barbarella. Right. And I think that's great for people that, you know, that it works for. But I think that now with these this sort of cascade of new voices, we're seeing a whole lot, you know, we're seeing gay sex in space and women, empowered women choosing partners and, you know, all kinds of things.
Cyborgs like Mindy.
That's right. You can have human cyborg interactions. Yes, yes. One of the interesting things about fan fiction, and this does relate to that too, was the subversive effect, where from the very start, writers were doing what they called slash fiction, which also comes into the novel. And the slash was, so you would have character name slash other character name. So it would be like, let's say the captain and his first mate, who are really just sort of colleagues on the show, are actually lovers in the fan fiction.
That was
just a huge development. Interestingly, you know, it might have been written by women, or you know, some people have said more recently, why weren't the women writing about you know, gay sex between women? Well, there weren't as many women characters to choose from.
I see. Yeah.
So, you know.
Now, do you want this book to be seen as a science fiction book, or purely as fantasy fiction, or what? Is there any way that you want it to be seen, or do you want everybody to see it universally?
I think it has, like I said, had a warm reception from science fiction readers, which I think makes sense, and I'm just so you know, moved and happy about that. But it, you know, originally I was thinking, well, it's literary fiction about science fiction, and I guess in a way it's just a crossover. It's also, you could take it as young adult, because she is a young adult. You know, just in the same way that Mindy keeps crossing over between those two worlds, I think that the book does too. So it's a little bit of a hybrid. I have heard from, you know, some people who've read it who really are not into science fiction definitively, and they say, oh, I just got so into the characters, it, you know, it didn't matter, and I enjoyed learning about the fandom. So yes, I think it can go in both directions.
What's next for Miriam Seidel?
I am actually working on a straight alternate world fantasy novel. So somehow this has pulled me closer into that science fiction and fantasy world.
Well, as you get that one into galley stages, let's get you back on the program. We can have another conversation. How does that sound?
That would be wonderful, Norman.
We have been talking to Miriam Seidel. Her book is called The Speed of Clouds. It's her debut novel. The links will be up at lifeelsewhere.co. Miriam Seidel, thank you so very much for joining us at Life Elsewhere.
Thank you so much, Norman. It's been great.
Thank you to my guests, and a very big thank you to you for listening. And those of you with keen ears will certainly recognize this piece of music. Yes, it's Bela Lugosi's Dead by Bauhaus. In the next edition of Life Elsewhere, my exclusive conversation with Bauhaus and Love and Rockets bass player David J. I don't want you to miss that. Till then, be well, be good, and always be nice. Bye.
You have been listening to Life Elsewhere, created and hosted by Norman B. Life Elsewhere is written and produced by Norman B. Guest booking and additional research by Stephanie Lane. Behind the scenes assistance by James Van, Bruce Goodman, and Allison Klein. We love to hear what you think about Life Elsewhere. Send your questions, queries, and comments to info@lifeelsewhere.co. That's C-O. Life Elsewhere is produced at the studios of WMNF Tampa.